From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, CRI Executive Vice President Dr. Larry Johnston sits in for Hank and is joined by Dr. Louis Marcos, Professor of English at Houston Baptist University and author of Atheism on Trial, Refuting the Modern Arguments Against God. Here now is Dr. Larry Johnston.
Thank you, Randy. This is Dr. Larry Johnston, Executive Vice President at CRI. I'm pinch hitting for Hank on this edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, as Hank is overseas speaking at an international conference. And it's my distinct pleasure today to speak with Dr. Louis Marcos, a professor of English and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. Lou is the author of 18 books and a contributor to the Christian Research Journal, CRI's flagship publication. And we are pleased to be offering Lou's newest book, Atheism on Trial, as our thanks this month to all of our listeners who are supporting the ministry. Lou, having truly feasted on your book, Atheism on Trial, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for taking time from what I know is a busy schedule to join us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Lou, as you know certainly better than most, critics and skeptics for two millennia have been putting Christianity on trial. And like other serious Christian scholars over the century, you've decided to return the favor and put atheism on trial. And what's cool is that you have invited us all to take our place in the jury box as you do so.
I think it's about time. We've been on the defensive so often. I think we need to go on the offensive, not to be offensive, but to understand that we have a worldview that is more integrated and coherent than any other worldview out there. And we do not have to be ashamed of the gospel, either in an emotional, spiritual way, or in a logical, rational way. We have the worldview, and we need to be unashamed and to come forward and speak up for it.
Amen. You know, having really genuinely benefited from your book, and one that I'll no doubt be reading more than once, I have a boatload of questions for you, and can we dive right in?
Let's dive in.
Terrific. In your introduction, you note that the modernist story portrays human civilization as a staircase that begins in darkness, ignorance, superstition, and barbarism, and ever so slowly ascends toward light, truth, science, secular humanism. I'm guessing that you have a problem with that narrative.
I do, and the problem is that this narrative has been fed to us so much that we don't even realize it is a constructed narrative. We have just taken for granted that this is somehow true. This is the way that things are and have been for the last thousand of years. But this is a modern construct. It's only as old as the Enlightenment, and really it's even less old than that in terms of the general public. We have been convinced, and I mean Christians, we who believe the revelation of the scripture, who believe that Christ has risen from the dead, without realizing it, like a fish in water, without realizing it, we have imbibed this notion that at the core of history is this thing called progress, that things naturally get better and better, that people get smarter and smarter, and that every time we have a new development, it somehow makes all the things before it wrong. C.S. Lewis came to call this chronological snobbery. The idea, two ideas, one is that if something is newer, it must be better. But deeper than that, what chronological snobbery means is if modern civilization no longer believes in something, let's say miracles, that must be because it was disproved by someone at some point. But guess what? That's not true. A lot of the things we no longer believe, I mean, the secular society no longer believes, they just stop believing it. They may have thought they disproved it, but they didn't. They just stopped believing it and convinced themselves, and to a certain extent, even believers, that all that old, quote, medieval stuff is old and has somehow been superseded by new developments in science or technology or psychology or anthropology or philosophy or whatever it is. But the fact of the matter is, these things, the tenets of Christianity, have not been disproven. They've just been moved beyond by people who have other motives. We may talk about those motives later, but the narrative is simply not true. We've imbibed it. We think it's true, but it's not. Our world has not created a genius on the level of, say, Aquinas or Dante or Aristotle or Augustine. Just because it's newer doesn't mean it's better.
Some stories, like the modernist story, become not just narratives, but meta-narratives. What's the distinction between narrative and meta-narrative, and what is the significance of stories achieving a meta-narrative status?
It's a good question. A narrative, of course, is just any story. But a meta-narrative is the controlling story. Now, as Christians, we do have a meta-narrative, and that meta-narrative is the story of creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. That is the overarching story of which we are a part, going back to Adam and Eve, to the fall, to Christ, and looking forward to the second coming when there will be a new heaven and a new earth. That is the meta means over, like metaphysics. That's the meta-narrative, the overarching narrative into which all other stories fit. Well, what the modern world has done is given us a new meta-narrative, and that's the meta. If there's one word, it's the word evolution. It is the idea that all things evolve, not just in terms of Darwin's idea of species evolving, but that everything evolves and somehow gets better, and everything else, like Christianity, gets left on the ash heap of history. So a meta-narrative means that this is your essential story, this is your essential truth, and everything else must be fit into that. Let me give you another example of a simple meta-narrative. From a Christian point of view, the meta-narrative says that everything begins in the spiritual realm and works its way down into the physical realm, in the beginning God. Everything is spiritual in the beginning, and out of that comes the physical. Not so the modern meta-narrative, which completely flips that on its head and says the origin of everything is matter, nature, physical things, and out of that evolves spiritual things. Or to put it in a simple way, God did not create man in the Christian meta-narrative. Man ultimately created God in the modernist meta-narrative.
Yeah, you touched on this briefly in passing, but I think it was the philosopher Santayana who said, I'm not sure entirely who it was that first discovered water, but I know it wasn't a fish. Kind of by way of analogy, this speaks to what you touched on, that like water to fish, we live within these meta-narratives so much that we're totally unaware of them, and that we can effortlessly, unconsciously get trapped in these bubbles.
Let me give you a good example of that bubble that only struck me maybe 5 years ago, just kind of as a moment of revelation. You know, any Christian that reads the Bible, you know, we notice that in the Old Testament, God has these kosher laws, which seem rather strange to us, not allowing Jews to eat pork or shellfish. And we try to figure out why that is. And me, like almost all modern Christians, we just take for granted that, well, we now know that pork and shellfish carry more diseases than a lot of other kinds of meats or other kinds of proteins, as the kids would call it today. And so, therefore, the reason God forbade pork and shellfish must be for health reasons. Now, that may be true, Larry, but it didn't strike me till a while ago that in making that immediate assumption, I was playing in to this modern meta-narrative that says God would not do something unless he had a good logical scientific health reason. And because we now worship health almost more than anything else, we just take for granted. We don't even think about it. We're in that water. We're in that scientific health water. And so immediately, as a sort of knee-jerk reaction, we think that must be the reason. Now, like I said, it might be the reason, but certainly the Old Testament says nothing about that. It's got something to do with holiness, which is a lot harder concept for us living in the modern world to understand. So again, it's very, very hard to think outside that bubble, even if you are a Christian who has access to God's direct revelation in the scriptures and the prophets and Christ himself. It's hard to think outside that bubble. And because science and technology have in many ways improved our lives, particularly in terms of health and labor-saving devices, we just take for granted now that therefore science, as it's practiced today, must have all the answers for everything else. We're in the bubble, and it's hard to see it.
And what advice would you give to those who are seeking to be aware of and perhaps break through their own bubbles, or to use an expression of yours that I like, to clear their eyes? What counsel would you give people who are aware of the tendency to effortlessly, unconsciously be embedded in these bubbles? How do we get out?
I tell you, one of the ways, this is kind of funny, but I think one of the most important disciplines to have when you become a husband or wife is the ability to sit down, if you're the man, if you're the husband, to be able to sit down and have a dialogue, internal dialogue, between yourself and your father, and try to figure out why you do the things that you do in your marriage. And if you really analyze yourself, you might notice that, let's say your wife said something and you got really mad and you don't know why. And then you stop and say, wait a minute, I know why I got mad, because that's the kind of thing that would have made my father exactly mad if my mother said that. And suddenly we've stepped out of ourselves and realized that we have internalized something so much we think it's ours when it isn't. We need to have that second vision. We need to step back and say, why did I say that? Why did I jump to that conclusion so quickly? Like the example I gave about the kosher laws. Why is it that without any thinking, I immediately took for granted it has to do with health? It's a way of having a sort of dialogue with yourself. Now, of course, the best way to heal this chronological snobbery is to read. And my book is a book of apologetics, but you might call it a book of historical apologetics, because I take the reader and myself through history looking at the Christians from the early church. And as I read them, suddenly I'm shocked and say, oh my gosh, there's nothing new under the sun. They struggled with these things as well. It's not something new that no one's ever heard of before. So, I mean, reading older, but not just new books, but reading older books, even sometimes pre-Christian writers like Plato and Aristotle, will give us a kind of distance and objectivity that will allow us to look at ourselves and think through why we think the way we think and why we react the way we do. And I'll just give you a real quick example here. I didn't come up with this. I read it in an article many years ago. But they said that the good Christian people fighting for pro-life, fighting against abortion, made a real deep error when they started adopting the language of rights. Because that's in the air, and because it seems so American, we always talk in terms of the language of rights. The trouble is, if you do that, you're going to kind of lose. If you put the rights of the mother up against the rights of an unborn child, our problem was we never should have adopted the language of rights. We should have stayed with the traditional language of duty and responsibility. But we get so caught up in this idea of rights and wanting our rights that we've adopted that language and hurt ourselves. Another example is when we had Christians, and I mean particularly conservative Christians that are fighting for the accuracy of the Bible, we made the mistake of arguing for the Bible on modern scientific terms rather than on the terms on which it was written. And what happens is we end up losing because we are taking a foreign concept and pushing it upon something that wasn't working within that concept. So again, it's a matter of getting objective distance, of stepping back and analyzing the way our mind works and the way it leaps from one conclusion to another. It's not an easy thing, but it's important. And it's not that different than, in a weird way, going to a good therapist who gets you to look at your behaviors and try to figure out why I get so anxious and paranoid when this happens.
I think related to those points, those people that know me know that I'm kind of a quote freak. I'm just always intrigued with the way that great minds have said things in powerful, memorable ways. And one of my favorite quotes of all time is a quote from the philosopher John Locke, who said, "In truth, the ideas and images in men's minds are the invisible powers that constantly govern them."
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin CRI Executive Vice President Dr. Larry Johnston and Professor Louis Marcos in their conversation. In recent years, atheists have forwarded virulent criticisms against Christianity, claiming that they have a more enlightened, scientific, and sophisticated worldview. Despite what these atheists might think, their verbal assaults are nothing new. In his book, Atheism on Trial, Dr. Louis Marcos confronts these recycled claims and shows that they have already been disproven by Christian thinkers of the past. And you can use the same logic to silence these claims today. To receive your copy of Atheism on Trial as our thanks for your support, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches. Or visit equip.org. We'll return with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast in just a few moments. With the new atheists increasing their mockery of Christianity and militant secularism ridiculing religious convictions of all stripes, we clearly don't need zealous but misguided Christians inviting further abuse by misreading and misrepresenting biblical prophecies. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will enable you to understand, remember, and communicate biblical prophecy. Moreover, your investment in Prophetic Stars through the Christian Research Institute will equip and encourage eager Christian brothers and sisters who genuinely yearn for truth and reliable tools to apprehend and defend their faith. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org.
In recent years, atheists have forwarded virulent criticisms against Christianity, claiming that they have a more enlightened, scientific, and sophisticated worldview. Despite what these atheists might think, their verbal assaults are nothing new. In his book, Atheism on Trial, Dr. Louis Marcos confronts these recycled claims and shows that they have already been disproven by Christian thinkers of the past. And you can use the same logic to silence these claims today. Are you ready to put atheism on trial? Get equipped with answers to the tough questions about your faith and speak with confidence, knowing that the trial of public opinion versus universal truth has already been held and Christ is the victor. To receive your copy of Atheism on Trial, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org.
A deeper understanding of the Bible's principles and truths will improve the spiritual, moral, and ethical problems facing our nation. Yet the obstacle isn't that the Bible doesn't speak to our greatest needs or answer our deepest questions. It's that the average person lacks the time and tools to extract the answers. That's why Hank Hanegraaff wrote the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. This expanded edition addresses over 210 of the top questions he's received as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Hank has taken the complex and made it simple and memorable. Receive the revised and updated complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI,
Make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. The role that listeners like you have played in CRI's ministry has always been vital. Now it could well be more critical than ever. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute during the financially critical month of June and receive Atheism on Trial by Dr. Louis Marcos as our thanks for your generous support. To make a gift to support CRI's many mind-changing outreaches, simply call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit us online at equip.org. Let's now rejoin CRI Executive Vice President Dr. Larry Johnston and Professor Louis Marcos in their conversation.
One of my favorite quotes of all time is a quote from the philosopher John Locke, who said, "In truth, the ideas and images in men's minds are the invisible powers that constantly govern them." I think Locke is onto something enormously significant here, and I think it might even be reflected in Proverbs 4:23, which says, "Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it." Now, the only problem that I have with that is that when we say heart, I think today people tend to moralize that and thus limit the application. And if I were giving an updated translation of that, I would say, today, above all else, guard your mind, for everything you do flows from it. Any thoughts on that?
Take every thought captive in Christ Jesus.
Yeah, amen.
And now what we have to add is, because we live in a visual age, not just take every thought captive, but take every image captive. Now, obviously, as Christians, we understand the meaning of that when it comes to something like pornography. That's pretty obvious. But there are other images that have nothing to do with pornography that sometimes get into us and we can't break out of them. I mean, maybe a good example of this is ever since Newton. Now, Newton was coming from a Christian or at least theistic point of view. People debate that. But was certainly coming from a believing standpoint, believing in God. But coming out of Newton, we've ended up moving into what's often called a clockwork universe. We start imagining that we're living in a great machine. And what happens is that we begin by treating nature and creation and the heavens as a machine, and sooner or later, we end up being part of that machine, as you would in a totalitarian government, where you are a cog in the machine. We need to understand that the universe is creation. It's not just a machine. It does run by laws. But we need to watch out. We start by treating nature as an object, as a thing to be studied and manipulated, and we end up treating man as an object to be manipulated. See, a lot of that comes out of an image. I'll give you, I know you're a Chesterton fan like I am. One of my favorite Chesterton quotes comes from the book Orthodoxy. And he says, people keep telling me we live in a clockwork universe. And they argue that by saying, you know, every day the sun rises, every day the sun sets, it's always the same. It must be a clockwork universe. And he stops and says, wait a minute. What if every morning God looks at the sun and says, do it again? And every night he looks at the moon and says, do it again. You know, sometimes when you're an adult, you put a little kid on your knee and you bounce him again and again and again until you're tired. And then you're all done and the kid looks at you and says, again, again. And you do it again until you're exhausted. Because the child, like God the Father, is full of energy and joy and never gets tired of monotony, whereas we have grown old and weary, and all we can see is the same old thing, and we've lost our joy for the beauty of nature. You know, maybe all daisies look alike because God never gets tired of making daisies.
Yeah, great.
So it's a matter of, to use a C.S. Lewis phrase, of baptizing not only our mind, but baptizing our imagination, to see the world afresh again and not let it just become a machine, an object to be studied. The universe isn't just our house, it's our home. that God created for us.
Yeah. For those just joining us, let me mention that this is Larry Johnston, Executive Vice President of CRI. I'm speaking with Dr. Lou Marcos, author of his new book, Atheism on Trial. Just want to mention that we're offering Lou's book this month to all of those people who are standing with CRI in this very crucial month of June, the end of our fiscal year. To receive a copy, simply go to equip.org. Or if you prefer to give by mail, simply send your gift to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina. That's 28271. Lou, in your book, you spend a fair amount of time addressing the contributions of a lot of different philosophers to some of the critical issues that we're discussing. But for those folks who weren't philosophy majors, when you talk about the pre-Socratic philosophers, who were the pre-Socratics, and in what sense were they evolutionists 2,000 years before Darwin?
Great. And let's talk about this, because the whole point of my book is that the new atheists want us to believe that they've come up with all these new arguments that will knock out Christianity for good. What I argue, and not just argue, but demonstrate by quoting the people, is that these arguments have been around for 2,600 years. And it really starts with a group of people called the pre-Socratic philosophers. They're called pre-Socratic because they come between 50 and 150 years before Socrates, starting about 600 BC. They have names like Thales and Anaximander and Anaximenes and Parmenides and Pythagoras and then Heraclitus, lots of different names. And these pre-Socratics, we don't have any books from them. What we have are fragments that are quoted by, say, Plato or Aristotle or Cicero or later people. So you can't buy a full book by one of these people, but you can buy a book of pre-Socratic philosophy and look at the various fragments that have been preserved. But we have enough preserved that we can understand the basic arguments they were writing. And yes, they were the first evolutionists. They decided, first of all, to stop asking questions like who and why. Those are the questions that religious people tend to ask: who, pointing to God, why, motivation. And they said, all we care about is what and how. We want sort of technical, programmatic answers. We're not interested in ultimate origins. We're just interested in the nature of things and how it works. And many of these pre-Socratics were evolutionists in the sense that they believed that at the core of everything was not spirit, but at the core of everything was matter. What a lot of people don't understand until they start reading old books is that the Bible is absolutely unique by beginning in the beginning God. It's not just in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Those four words are absolutely revolutionary: in the beginning God. Because in every other ancient book, whether you're looking at Greek mythology, Roman, Norse, Egyptian, Native American, whenever you go back and look at their stories, it's always not in the beginning God, but in the beginning stuff, in the beginning matter. The Greeks had a word for it that's come directly into our language. That word is chaos. And the word chaos means undifferentiated matter. And they believe that this is true of every ancient myth, including what I'm going to be calling the myth of evolution, that in the beginning, all there was matter floating around. And just randomly by chance, that matter slowly evolved into all the things that we know. And guess what? Not only did we, human beings, come out of the matter, if they believed in gods, they believed that the gods came out of the matter as well. In the beginning is matter, not God, not spirit, but stuff. And they, the pre-Socratics, probably the best way we know them today is they're the ones that started talking about how everything was composed of the four elements: earth, air, fire, and water. That idea goes right on through the Renaissance, almost into the Enlightenment, used in different ways. But they were interested in finding the physical, material, natural building blocks of things. And even if they did believe in the gods, they found them irrelevant in terms of explanation or science. They just sort of left them on the side and argued. Now, the most fascinating of all was a man named Epicurus, the founder of Epicureanism, and he and his famous poet heir, a man named Lucretius, who wrote in the first century B.C., they had a really kind of cool idea. They were called atomists. Now, an atom, that's a Greek word that means cannot be divided. So an atom is the smallest unit of matter. And what the atomists like Epicurus and Lucretius believed is that everything in the universe is composed of either an atom, a little bit of matter, or space, a void. That's all there is. These atoms moving through empty space, what they called the void, and they just moved on randomly. And every so often, for no reason, one of them swerved and hit another one. And out of that swerve comes everything that we know. It's basically evolution. It's a view of the world that's binary. Everything's a one or a zero. And out of the random dance of those atoms comes everything that we know. So again, this idea that everything we see around us could have arrived here merely through physical natural processes and time and chance was in no way invented by Darwin or the evolutionists of the 19th century. That's been around with us for at least 2,600 years and has been debated for that long. And it's never been proven, of course.
Yeah, you know, if we say in the beginning today, most Christians would complete that with, you know, God created the heavens and the earth. But for most secularists, when you say in the beginning, a natural association that they would make is, of course, the Big Bang. But
right.
A lot of Christians have not thought through the theistic implications or the theological implications of the Big Bang. And I'm curious as to how really dedicated materialists like Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking avoided those implications.
You know, it really is amazing. It's so disingenuous. I mean, Stephen Hawking, he's one of the ones that popularized the Big Bang in the beginning, his famous book, A Brief History of Time and whatnot. He popularized it until suddenly he realized, I'm not sure what moment he realized, the theistic implication that if there's a Big Bang, there must be a Big Banger. Because in fact, there is nothing before the Big Bang. The Big Bang didn't just create matter. The Big Bang created matter and space and time. Before the Big Bang, there was nothing. And I think at some point he suddenly realized, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. And then he started doing, I mean, I'm sorry, this is not even science. This is science fiction. One of the things that Stephen Hawking did, and others have jumped in on it, but he tried to get around the theistic implications of there was a beginning to the universe and there was nothing before that beginning. The way he got around it was by theorizing what he called multiverse theory, multiple universe, multiverse theory. And he's like, oh yeah, it is impossible for a universe just to pop out of nowhere, right? Because, I mean, literally, the odds of getting what we have by chance, the odds actually exceeds the number of atoms in the universe. You know, the odds would be literally like throwing a dart and hitting one atom in the entire universe. Okay, that just doesn't happen. But he theorized, what if an infinite number of universes are always popping into being, popping, dying, back and forth? If that were the case, then the odds would be okay that one of those universes would be the kind that we have that allows for human life, or life of any kind, but especially of human life.
We'll pick up CRI Executive Vice President Dr. Larry Johnston's conversation with Professor Louis Marcos in just a few moments. The Christian Research Institute is blessing people around the world through our many outreaches. From broadcasts, podcasts, the Christian Research Journal, and the millions of yearly visits to equip.org coming from all parts of the world, it's no exaggeration to say that these would all quickly disappear without friends like you. And because June is one of the most financially critical months of the year, we're praying for an outpouring of support. We are passionate about proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ, and the need for these outreaches has never been greater. Stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute during the key month of June and receive a copy of Atheism on Trial by Dr. Louis Marcos as our thanks for your support. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. That's 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be right back with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. With over 500,000 copies in print, Hank Hanegraaff's Bible Answer books were born out of his many years of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. He's taken his on-air answers to questions and chiseled them until only the gems emerge. Questions involving biblical interpretation, cults, science, ethics, apparent contradictions, and much more. This remarkable collection of concise answers is now even better. My goal, says Hank, is to take the complex and make it simple and memorable. Receive your copy of the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated, as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org.
In recent years, atheists have forwarded virulent criticisms against Christianity, claiming that they have a more enlightened, scientific, and sophisticated worldview. Despite what these atheists might think, their verbal assaults are nothing new. In his book, Atheism on Trial, Dr. Louis Marcos confronts these recycled claims and shows that they have already been disproven by Christian thinkers of the past. And you can use the same logic to silence these claims today. Are you ready to put atheism on trial? Get equipped with answers to the tough questions about your faith and speak with confidence, knowing that the trial of public opinion versus universal truth has already been held and Christ is the victor. To receive your copy of Atheism on Trial, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org.
Endless predictions about end-time events and published timetables counting down the end have proven to be wrong 100% of the time. When doomsday predictions fail, there is double-duty damage. Many theologically juvenile and scripturally superficial Christians abandon the faith as a result of these failed predictions, and the public image of Christianity is damaged, making Christians appear to be hopelessly naive and easily duped biblical bumpkins. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will equip you not only to interpret biblical prophecy correctly, but to remember it as well. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. From the Bible Answer Man broadcast and the Hank Unplugged podcast, to the Christian Research Journal and CRI's vast free website resources accessed by more than 200,000 users each month, these would all quickly disappear without friends like you. And because truth and knowledge are indispensable weapons in the battles now being fought for our future as a free people, as thanks for your support, Hank Hanegraaff is offering Professor Louis Marcos' new book, Atheism on Trial, Refuting the Modern Arguments Against God. To receive your copy of Atheism on Trial, just call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches during the financially crucial month of June. 888-7000-CRI or visit us online at equip.org. Let's again listen in as CRI Executive Vice President Dr. Larry Johnston and Professor Louis Marcos continue their conversation on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
Stephen Hawking theorized, what if an infinite number of universes are always popping into being? If that were the case, then the odds would be okay that one of those universes would be the kind that we have that allows for human life. Now, this is what the people who speak Yiddish would call chutzpah, okay? You cannot explain how one universe came into being by chance, and so you get out of that by theorizing that billions of them came out of nowhere.
Madness.
So this is how they get away with it is unbelievable. But, you know, to the day he died, he kept trying. Now, later, in the 5 years or so before he died, then he started coming up with other theories. He said, well, okay, all we really need, right, for order is the law of gravity. If we have the law of gravity, that can organize things. Okay, first of all, there's two problems there. Number one, there is nothing before the Big Bang. Now, all of a sudden, he's suggesting the law of gravity. There's nothing before the Big Bang. But even beyond that, again, the modern secularist has this way of taking words like gravity, nature, and chance, and imbuing them with some kind of consciousness and ability to do things. The law of gravity doesn't do anything. In fact, the law of gravity has no meaning until there is physical matter that's moving. So you can't have a law of gravity before the Big Bang because there's nothing. The law of gravity measures something. It doesn't actually cause stones to fall to Earth. It merely is a law that measures that attractive power. So he keeps getting – one of my favorite ones, though, is Carl Sagan. Now, again, if you're, you know, my age or, you know, if you've been around for a while, you'll remember – I guess it must have been around 1980, 1979 when Carl Sagan came out with the famous show called Cosmos, which has been rebooted, right? That DeGrasse Tyson, whatever his name is, I think
yes.
He rebooted it. But the original Cosmos, again, that way we watched that on PBS. Everybody was glued to their television sets on Sunday night. Now, Carl Sagan – began that show with a famous phrase that he seems to think is scientific, but is absolutely metaphysical and philosophical. He began by saying the cosmos is all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be. Now, first of all, you realize that that's a very kind of nasty stealing of Revelation chapter 4, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty who was and is to come. Now, suddenly the cosmos is all there ever is, all there ever was, all there ever will be. But here's the problem with that statement. Now, in the year 1980, regular dudes like you and I did not know that the Big Bang had been proven. It hadn't quite made its way into popular culture. But by 1980, any scientist who was in the end, like Carl Sagan, knew. But long before 1980, they had already basically proven the Big Bang because they saw the universe was expanding. They even found what's called the smoking gun, the background radiation. So Carl Sagan himself knew about the Big Bang. And yet he makes this unbelievably disingenuous thing saying the cosmos is all there ever was. He's still going back. Okay, throughout the 20th century, a lot of top scientists, including and especially Einstein, fiercely resisted what he saw. He noticed that the universe was expanding. He knew what this meant. If it was expanding from a point, it must have started. And Einstein himself fiercely resisted the idea that the universe had a beginning because he knew what the implications were. And he even came up with what he would later call a fudge factor to try to explain away the expansion of the universe. And later on, he admitted it was probably the biggest scientific mistake he'd made. They wanted to believe in the 20th century in what they called the steady state theory, the belief that the universe or cosmos has always been here. And again, that's been, as much as science can disprove anything, has been disproven. The universe has a beginning, and that beginning came out of nothing. So suddenly, in the beginning, God becomes a sort of scientific statement. It's funny how things come around.
What I find absolutely fascinating, and this simply revisits the power of meta-narrative, when I read minds as bright as Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking, I keep coming up against what I call Houdini hermeneutics.
I love that.
they are so committed to the ABT position, anything but theism. They just absolutely cannot allow a divine foot in the door, that they will bend and distort, filter, refract state metaphysical statements in an effort to make them scientific, and they're unaware of their own encapsulation. You know, I'm intrigued. At one point in your book, you refer to the Darwinian myth, because definitions of myth vary. In what sense is Darwinism a myth?
Okay, the word myth doesn't necessarily mean a lie. A myth is a story, usually either about origins or about endings, like the afterlife or punishment and reward and things like that. A myth is a story that helps us to understand why things are the way they are. Sometimes it may be merely a story. Other times it can have historical validity to it. But the trouble, and this goes right back, that the founder of the intelligent design movement was a great guy named Philip E. Johnson. And in his book called Darwin on Trial, I don't know, maybe 25 years now that came out, 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget it. Philip E. Johnson made this statement everybody should memorize. He says, there is the theory of Darwinism and the fact of Darwinism. And the Darwinists want to make that distinction. They want to say that the theory of, or let's say evolution, that the theory of evolution is whatever theory we're using right now, whatever fusion of ideas. That's the theory of evolution. But that should be contrasted with the fact of evolution, that is, that it actually happened. As Philip E. Johnson argues, there is no difference between the fact of evolution and the theory of evolution. They are the same thing. There is no fact of evolution separate from the stories they keep telling us. And a good example of that is that the modern theory of Darwinian evolution is really anti-Darwinian, because the biggest thing that Darwin said over and over is that nature takes no leaps. The word for a leap in Latin is saltation. There's no saltation. Nature cannot leap. Everything has to be slow, incredibly slow, gradual changes. And Richard Dawkins is always saying that to us as if we're five-year-olds trying to explain it to us again and again and again. But in fact, modern Darwinian evolution believes that there is this thing called mutations that cause sudden changes in species. That comes from a guy named Stephen Gould.
Yes.
Stephen Jay Gould came up with a theory called punctuated equilibrium, or punk-eep, that shows how species just suddenly leap forward due to mutations. So the modern theory of Darwinian evolution is almost anti-Darwinian because it keeps taking leaps. But the point is that the theory is always changing, always playing the Houdini hermeneutics you just explained. But there is no fact of it. There's just the story that we want to hold on to. And you need to understand that, okay, if you believe in modernism, if you believe the idea that in the beginning there's only matter and everything comes out of matter and everything is by chance, okay, if that is your meta-narrative, well, every meta-narrative has to have an origin story to justify itself. I mean, if you're a Darwinian and you have a certain view of the universe, but you can't explain how you got here, that's a pretty sorry meta-narrative, a pretty sorry story. And I'm making this point, Larry, because there's something that a lot of people haven't recognized. Okay, when you look at the founders of modernism, you do know that Marx has very much been shown to be in error in so many ways. He's really, I mean, there are still Marxist places, but Marx has been discredited in many ways. Freud has been discredited in many ways. Sartre has been, almost all the founders of Margaret Mead has been discredited. But the one person that the academy will not discredit is Darwin. They just keep holding on to him, and they won't let go of him. And to me, it's kind of nonsensical. Could you imagine if you said to me, hey, the Earth rotates around the sun, and you tried to prove that to me by going back to Galileo? Okay, you really don't have to go back to Galileo. Okay, we got plenty of proof of that right now. But when it comes to evolution, people come going back to Darwin, who got so many things wrong. Darwin thought that our cells were just a little blob of material. He didn't have even an inkling of the unbelievable complexity of the DNA and the miniature machines, the molecular machines that run through our body at a microscopic level. And yet people keep going back to Darwin and will not let him go, as if he proved something. You see what I mean? It's very, very odd. But people will not let go of Darwin. And even a lot of Christian apologists sometimes are too timid to speak up against Darwin because he is defended to the last. Everybody else can be thrown to the lions, but not Darwin, because we can't have our meta-narrative if we don't have a sense of how we got here ourselves.
Yeah, a very prominent Chinese scientist was visiting the United States, and after he had been in the United States some time, he posed the profound observation that he said, in the United States, we can question God, but not Darwin. And in China, you can question Darwin, but not God. Again, it shows the power of meta-narrative. In your book, you talk about a good number of philosophers. Spinoza is one, and he's a towering figure in philosophy, but one that many Christians would be unfamiliar with. Who was Spinoza, and what did he mean when he said that God and nature are one?
Let me talk about Spinoza. I have a good friend that I dedicated my book to. His name is Gilbert Farah, and he's the one that got me. He's a believer and a skeptic back and forth. He's a good partner that I debate with all the time. And he's the one that finally got me to sit down and read Spinoza's Ethics. And after I read it, I was just amazed because he's very rarely taught. You hear the name, but I don't remember ever learning any. And I went to all secular schools. I don't remember learning anything about Spinoza. And when I read it, it was like the missing piece explaining modernism. Spinoza's only a little bit after Descartes. He's actually before the Enlightenment, 17th century, but he's blazing the way for things that are to come. And in one sense, I respect Spinoza because he was a very brave person. I mean, he was actually one of the few people, he was Jewish, but secular Jewish, but he was rejected by the Jewish community and rejected by the Christian community. I mean, he made everybody mad at himself, and he was very, very brave and led a difficult life. But when you read Spinoza, he pretends like he believes in God, but he doesn't. He basically says that God and nature are the same thing. Some people call that monism, that everything is one. Body and soul are the same. God and nature are the same. But what really happens in Spinoza, by making God and nature the same, all you really have is nature. Because if God is nature, then he's no longer God.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again tomorrow when we'll continue the conversation between CRI Executive Vice President Dr. Larry Johnston and Houston Baptist University Professor of English Dr. Louis Marcos. In appreciation for your gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches during the key month of June, Hank Hanegraaff would like to send you a copy of Atheism on Trial, Refuting the Modern Arguments Against God by Dr. Louis Marcos. Just call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. Or simply visit online at equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated, is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org.
In recent years, atheists have forwarded virulent criticisms against Christianity, claiming that they have a more enlightened, scientific, and sophisticated worldview. Despite what these atheists might think, their verbal assaults are nothing new. In his book, Atheism on Trial, Dr. Louis Marcos confronts these recycled claims and shows that they have already been disproven by Christian thinkers of the past. And you can use the same logic to silence these claims today. Are you ready to put atheism on trial? Get equipped with answers to the tough questions about your faith and speak with confidence, knowing that the trial of public opinion versus universal truth has already been held and Christ is the victor. To receive your copy of Atheism on Trial, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org.